Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning, in the first hour, we'll take up a topic that we certainly have discussed before and probably many times over the last couple of decades. We'll be talking about public education and things that might be done in terms of restructuring, changes in the classroom, changes at the district level, things that might be done to improve the quality of public education, improve student performance, and improve teacher performance. Over the years, certainly a lot of things have been suggested, and while there may have been some overall improvement in public education, there is still reason for concern, particularly when it comes to performance in some of the country's biggest urban school systems. And the question that we'll be talking about here this morning with our guest is this: is it possible that you can take some lessons from business and from business management and apply them to schools? And I think that our guest would say, yes, you can do that, keeping in mind, I know they would say, that schools aren't businesses and you can't manage them like businesses, but that doesn't mean that you can't take some things from business management principles and apply them and see some benefit on the school side. We have two guests with us this morning, both of them joining us by telephone, and they're both researchers at the Harvard Business School. Stacy Childress is a lecturer in the Entrepreneurial Management Unit at Harvard Business School. She's also co-founder and senior researcher of the Public Education Leadership Project at Harvard, and we'll be talking about that this morning in the show. Among other things, she looks at entrepreneurial activity and public education in this country, including things like behavior and strategies of leadership teams in urban public school districts, also charter schools, and other kinds of nonprofit efforts who are trying to improve the public school system. Also joining us is Alan Grossman. He is professor of management practice, also at the Harvard Business School, and in his research focuses on leadership and management in public education. He's a faculty chair for the Public Education Leadership Project, and they're both joining us by telephone. And as we talk, questions from people who are listening are certainly welcome. We encourage people to do that. All we do ask is that people just try to be brief, and we ask that so that we can keep the program moving along and get as many different people in as possible. But questions from listeners are certainly encouraged. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 or WILO. And toll-free, 800-222-WILO. Well, Stacy Childress, hello.
Good morning, David.
And Alan Grossman.
Good morning, David.
Thank you both for giving us some of your time. We certainly appreciate it.
Delighted just to be with you.
As a general kind of comment, and I'd give you both the opportunity to talk a little bit about it, and I guess I would ask Stacy to go first. I'm thinking about the fact that here, for example, on this program, going back now probably a couple of decades, I've talked with quite a lot of people about public schools and gotten a lot of different ideas about how things could be changed, could be restructured, different approaches to the way the school is set up, different approaches to curriculum, all kinds of things aimed at trying to improve the quality of education. And while it is true, as I said, and I think it's true, that overall there have been some improvements, it's not what we would like to see, and that there are certainly are places and big city school districts are among them where the performance is really not what it should be, what we'd want it to be. So not saying that there aren't individual schools that are doing well, but I think the issue that concerns both of you and other educators is that overall in these systems, the performance is not where it should be. And I guess I wonder, you know, why do you think it is that given as much time and effort and thought that's gone into school reform over the past decades is that we haven't gotten more out of it? Why the performance overall isn't better?
David, I mean, obviously that's the big question, and it's one that we have really tried to focus on. You mentioned that we've seen progress over the decades in individual school performance. And one of the things that we found in our work is that in any school in the country, even if it's a low-performing school, you can find good classrooms with teachers doing amazing work with students. You can find terrific schools in districts that are underperforming. What we haven't seen yet, as you allude to, is a school district, Chicago or any other, that has hundreds of schools, figure out a way to spread the great performance that's going on in individual classrooms, individual schools, across their entire systems. One of the findings of our work has been that districts and those that support them, foundations, policymakers, and others, often focus on school-based solutions without thinking through all of the pieces of the larger organization around a school that have to be put in place to support that school in order to produce high performance. And so one of the pieces of our work is how does a district office and other organization units within a district that support schools, how do those parts of the organization think about their work in a new way, which is how do we equip every school in the district and create the conditions in every school in the district, not just some of our schools, but every school. How do we create the systems and structures and the culture around those schools that will drive high performance? And that's a different mindset than how do we put more constraints on schools that aren't performing well, and how do we bear down on them harder so that they will perform well. One of the things we say in our article is how can we expect schools that are low performing to fix themselves? They need the structure around them. And so most our work has focused on how as a system can a school district create conditions in schools that mirror those that are high performing.
Well, that prompts a follow-up question. Do you think it is the case that too much, when we have looked at schools that were underperforming, our way of dealing with that, or perhaps within systems the way of dealing with that, is to say to that school, essentially, we're going to punish you for underperforming rather than trying to ask the question, what can we do to try to make this school better?
I think oftentimes that's the case. Obviously, accountability is important, and clear expectations for performance and holding people accountable for meeting those expectations is very important. And I think as a country, we're getting better at that. But it's also the case, we see some evidence in some school systems where, again, from the district perspective, how do we create support systems for our low-performing schools so that the adults in those schools who are well-intentioned and who are working hard have better tools, better supports, better ideas to do good work with their students? And so San Francisco is actually an example of this, where they have a program that certainly holds principals of low-performing schools accountable, but also provides a set of supports around them that are producing some good results there.
Mm-hmm. Let me turn to Alan Grossman, and you can pick up on what Stacy was saying and take it any way you want. I guess one thing, though, that it makes me think about is, when you're talking about a large district, say Chicago, for example, and that's one of the places where you've been doing work, I'm sure that it's complicated enough if you're a superintendent of a district and maybe you have a dozen schools. Maybe you got 20. When you're looking at a district the size of San Francisco or New York or Chicago or some big urban district like that, I'm sure that the problems are staggering simply because the numbers of schools and the number of students are staggering.
You're absolutely right, which is the exact reason we started focusing on the system as a whole. So if you look across any organization, let's take a for-profit, a large multinational organization, complex, difficult to manage, spread around the globe, there aren't any that function well unless they're well-organized, well-managed, and well-led. The same is true for a school system, and this is where the comparison is important. We've observed that if they're well-managed, they have at least a chance of becoming high-performing. If they're not well-managed, there's very little chance of that. And in reality, there's been almost no work, there's no model out there for superintendents to say, how do I go about doing this? How do I take this complex system and make the pieces all fit together so that they're all focused on one thing, which is what happens in the classroom, which improves that interaction between the teacher and the student? So that's not very different conceptually, when you think about it, of any large organization which has multiple units delivering their services. If they don't do a good job at the level where the customer is, then that organization is going to fail, whether it's a for-profit or a non-profit. So there hasn't been any research done here. There hasn't been any real practical information available superintendents, bits and pieces. And we're trying to take this as an integrated whole and say, this is where you think about it. Here are some ideas. Here's some ways that others are doing it that we can all learn together.
Mm-hmm. Just one sort of thought that comes to mind is that some of the conversations and a lot of things that I've read over time about school reform, when you look at the level of the individual school, is that people are saying that we need to redefine the job description of the principal. And that the idea is that the principal of an individual school is supposed to be maybe not so much a boss as a team leader, and that it's the job of the principal to support the teachers in the classroom and to try to actually give them a fair amount of autonomy to decide how it is, what is my best way to teach on this day with these students to teach this lesson, because that's always, it's going to be different from day to day and from group to group and so forth. Now, I don't know if we're talking about the same thing when we're scaling up, but is it still possible to do what you're trying to do, which sounds like you're arguing for a pretty strong kind of central authority in a sense, and at the same time give schools on an individual level the kind of autonomy that allows them to adjust and to tailor the approach to the students that they're dealing with at that point?
I think, David, you've actually identified how we think about this. We're not prescribing here that a central office should be a command and control kind of entity and should not have a relationship with the individual schools that demands or commands what they should do. But what a central office does that individual schools cannot do is it can marshal resources, because when you look at schools, for example, the experience of principals ranges from brand new, who really haven't had much experience, to some who have been there many years who perhaps aren't performing, to some who are at the peak of their careers. What does the district do to provide them with the services they need so they can interact in an effective way with the teachers? That's one thing. A district also is the only entity that can set a common accountability system for all the schools, that can create a common culture for all the schools, because as much as we do want variability across schools in the way they approach their teaching and learning, we don't want variability in performance. And we can identify a culture of collaboration, a culture of cooperation, a culture focused on high expectations that a district can help create across the entire district. So I would say it's not so much authority as it is the logical entity to provide the kind of services, the kind of ability to share best practices, the kind of motivation, and at the end of the day, the kind of accountability so that there are consequences to lack of performance. But it is a balance, and you've identified that balance between autonomy at the school level, but autonomy within a context of expectations and measurable performance. Just one other thing. Chicago, for example, has set goals for the year 2010, measured annually within each school. And these goals are numerical, and they're very they're very precise. The principals help set the goals. And at this point, the principals are being held accountable, but with a great deal of latitude as to how they're going to get it done in their building.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to turn back to Stacy here. And I know the thing that caught our eye and got us interested in having this conversation was an article that you all were involved in writing for the Harvard Business Review that laid out some of the things that you're trying to do with the Public Education Leadership Project. And in here, there's a sort of a sidebar, an extended sidebar about Chicago. And one of the things that's very striking here has to do with this very issue of autonomy. And I'm sure the difficulty of giving sufficient autonomy and yet not having autonomy run wild. And one of the things here that's really striking here is the comment that maybe in Chicago, in that system, there was a little too much autonomy. And here the article says that maybe that in part might explain why, for example, there were more than 85 different reading programs in use throughout the district. And I could understand that you might want to have some range of choice for teachers, and obviously it's important to suit the style of your teaching to the student and all that. But maybe even in a district as large as Chicago, 85 different reading programs is maybe about 30 too many. How do you go about that sort of balancing act between saying that there's got to be some, you've got to place some limits on what you do, and part of the job of the central administration is to say, look, here's an approach we think works. Let's do this. And within that, then give your teachers and your principals at individual schools some freedom to find out what they think for them and for their students works best.
That's right. As you pointed out, the notion that a system as large as the Chicago Public Schools with 600 schools should be set up with some dichotomy of either schools have autonomy or the central office is in control is just not workable. And we've tried to push the conversation in all of the districts that we've worked in and in our work beyond that, what we consider to be a false dichotomy. It's either centralized or it's decentralized. The problems of urban education have been with us for long enough and are difficult enough that our move between local autonomy of schools back to centralization, the central office in systems like Chicago over the years hasn't solved the problem. And so while it is important that adults who are closest to students have the latitude to use professional judgment about how to go about the process of instruction day to day in a way that meets children's needs, it's also the case that in a large system, there are some things that are known about what works. And, you know, central office role working with high-performing principals who have a lot of experience, to come together and decide, maybe it's not 85 reading programs, maybe it's 30, maybe it's 10. You know, which of these do we believe, given what we think works in instruction, can we all agree are the best 10 reading programs for our system, and then offer some choice within those. And we've seen some evidence in some school systems. Aldine, Texas is an example, and we use them as an example in the article that you mentioned, where they actually engaged teachers in that conversation. Which of the curricular programs that we're using work better than the others, and how can we as a team across levels, central office, schools in between, make some decisions together about which programs we think work, and then hold each other accountable for implementing those. So rather than who gets to decide what, can we decide together what we think works, and then allocate the responsibilities for implementation to the level of the organization that makes sense. You know, you're mentioning principals. It's great for principals to have a lot of latitude, a lot of autonomy in running their buildings every day. Principals that we talk to actually don't want to have to reinvent the wheel on some pretty basic things, that they would rather the central office or some regional office mechanism provide for them, things like transportation and building maintenance and those kinds of things. Principals don't want to reinvent the wheel. They want to focus on being creative in things that matter with instruction for children.
Mm. Let me again introduce our guest with this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Stacy Childress and Alan Grossman. Stacy Childress is a lecturer in the Entrepreneurial Management Unit at Harvard Business School, and Alan Grossman is professor of management practice at Harvard Business School, and both of them are involved in the Public Education Leadership Project, which is a joint project that involves Harvard Business School and the Harvard Graduate School of Education. And among other things, what they did was they went out and they studied some very large public school districts across the country and looked at what was working and what wasn't, particularly concentrating on the central management of the district. And they looked at a number of very big districts, among them Chicago, also Long Beach, California, Memphis, Tennessee, Philadelphia, Portland, Oregon, San Diego, San Francisco, and trying to identify some basic principles. And in a sense, also, as I said at the beginning, kind of leaning on this idea, well, are there some things that you can learn, some lessons you can take from business management that you can apply to the management of school districts? And while they would say, now that we are talking about two different things, schools are one thing, businesses are another thing, that there are some lessons that can be learned. Questions here are welcome to 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Since we are here not all that far from Chicago, there might indeed be some Chicago people listening to the show this morning, maybe you might talk a little bit more about Chicago, and about what you learned there and perhaps what sort of things that you were able to tell them that you think actually were helpful.
Well, one of the things about this project, and we did partner with the School of Education. We also partnered with nine urban school districts. So we worked with Chicago and eight others for the last 4 years. It wasn't so much our telling them; it was our discovering together. Since, as I said earlier, there was no model, we brought back some of these ideas. We wrote business cases about them, and then came back and discussed it with the district and said, well, what makes sense here? What seems to work? What doesn't seem to work? How would you, as a team, a leadership team that came to campus for a week each of the last 3 years, how would you adapt what you need to have from this particular case into your district? Because the conversation is always around what's best for the student, what's best for performance. So they were very much our partners as well, and they went out and tried some of the things and then reported back. So, for example, in Chicago, this notion of a scorecard for all of their schools, it was something they discussed here on campus based on some cases that we all worked on together. And this past year, they have now 17 indices where they rank in four categories how each high school is doing. And in each of these categories, it compares one high school where it stands among all the high schools, the 117 in the district. The key here is that this was done not only so that high schools would know where they stand relative to their peers, but it was driven by a parent's desire to have better information so they could make informed decisions about where their children should be going to high school.
Well, I just let me ask you, and again, this is maybe I'm getting hung up on numbers here, but I'm thinking about the fact that, say, for example, you're taking a district like Chicago, which is really big. There are more than 430,000 students in this district, and as you just mentioned, there are 117 high schools, just high schools in the Chicago district. And I don't know what what the size of the central staff is, how many people work for the superintendent of Chicago schools, but I don't know how even a manageable number of people that you could support would be enough to try to even keep up with what was going on in all of these schools.
The way you're right, again, that's the challenge. But one of the things, so for example, that we are working on together is it seems very obvious that they need really well-run information systems. So in the case of Chicago, by next year, they will have an information system in place that tracks the progress of every student or every cohort of students, meaning if I'm in grade 2 and move to grade 3, it looks at the relative gain rather than saying this is what grade 2 does this year and this is what grade 3 does next year, which is not a very good measure of improvement. So technology has to be introduced in a way that it had never been used in public schools before. People, you're right, they didn't have a clue. They really didn't know the progress of the students. We interviewed a superintendent in a large urban system that said up until we started to receive pressure at the state and the federal level, we simply did not know how well our students were doing. We knew how many graduated. We knew how many went to pretty good schools, but we didn't track this. This era has really changed the whole equation in terms of how schools look at their own performance. Yes, it's difficult. Yes, it's complex. But I don't think we should get too hung up on large numbers, because really good technology, good systems, good thinking can manage large systems. And by the way, you know, these aren't, you just don't look at it in aggregate. There are 24 area instructional officers who actually break down the number of schools under management. So the district itself isn't managing directly 617 schools. What they're actually have intermediaries with teams that are managing smaller units of schools.
Mm. Stacey, anything you want to add to that?
Well, I you know, the last point that Alan was making, I think, was a really important step forward for Chicago. You know, prior to 2001 or so, there were six people at the central office who were responsible for managing 600 schools. So they each had 100 schools in their portfolio of responsibility. When you start to get into those kinds of numbers, each of those six people are basically managing groups of schools that are larger than most districts in the country at 100 schools each. And the step to go to 24 people, they're called area instructional officers, that are managing groups of schools and who have a very clear charge from the senior leadership team: focus on improving instruction. You have, 18 to 30 schools that you're responsible for. We'll help you figure out other ways to get all of the more business and administrative mechanical tasks done. Your goal is to work with this set of principals on improving what happens in the classroom. And I think that kind of focus within a span of control that is reasonable and manageable for one individual to take responsibility for just makes the relationship between school principals and their person at central office that they're accountable to much more likely to be successful and supportive versus a command and control. If you have 100 schools to manage, basically all you can do is provide some high-level oversight. If you've only got 20 to 24, which is still significant, but more manageable, you can really get into what kinds of differentiated kinds of problems school to school exist and provide a different kind of level of customer support from that central office level.
David, I just wanted to add one thing, if I might.
Sure.
And, when we are observing school systems around the country, we see some small urban districts that are just doing terribly. And over the past 3 or 4 years, some of these small districts, and while I agree that size adds complexity, these small districts are actually vastly underperforming in terms of improvement than some of the largest districts. If you take New York, which has really reorganized itself, which has new leadership in a district that we're writing cases in right now and that we're studying, they've made significant gains over the last 2 or 3 years. They have 1,200 schools and about 1,200,000 students. So compared to Chicago, Chicago looks small time compared to that. It's a third the size. So I agree that there is an enormous complexity added into size. But on the other hand, there doesn't seem to be a correlation between a district that's improving in terms of an urban area and its size.
We have a couple of callers to bring into the conversation, so why don't we do that first in Belgium, nearby community of Belgium, and this is our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I have to state up front that I'm not involved in the educational system, but I wake up every morning next to somebody who does, and very, very involved with it. And as I'm sure Mr. Inge and you people who are involved with him, you're old enough to know when the school systems have changed over the last period of about 30 years or so. And things are substantially different. And if you put two school teachers together in any kind of situation, you're going to hear things. And you're going to hear them talk because they immediately start talking about it. And there's been a dramatic change in the way education has been put together now, where it's not education that seems to be coming first so much. It is measuring the degree to which children are being educated. In other words, we're going to test them. We're going to take care of this little fact. We're going to take care of that little fact. We're going to track this. We're going to track that. And on and on. And now we seem to have forgotten one of the most important things about an education, and that is getting educated. The curriculums don't seem to be as advanced as they used to be, and they don't seem to be moving along quite the way they used to, as I remember I had when I was in school. And now it seems back in the day, when I was a young man, there was always that fear that there would be corporal punishment if you didn't do what you were supposed to do. And that focused a lot of young minds and kept them busy on the topic at hand, which was education, instead of sleeping in the back of the classroom or fooling around with whatever level they wanted to fool around at. And I noticed that that's what a lot of educators talk about now. It's not so much that they want to be involved with corporal punishment. No, don't get me wrong there. It's that education is not what it used to be. It's not educating students anymore. It's fulfilling all these requirements for the administration to measure their improvement or lack thereof. And we're really missing the point that we need to do is educate a child. Can you comment on that?
Well, I'll pick somebody. Stacey, you can go first, and then Alan could, and you can respond to either point. And obviously, I'm sure a lot of people have the same concerns that the caller does about, on the one hand, the seeming obsession we have with assessment, and then what I guess I hear is the problem of discipline and having to deal with students that are acting out, misbehaving, not paying attention, you know,
right.
Whatever.
Right. Well, on the first point, on the testing and assessment point, obviously this is something that you hear from educators at all levels, and in particular teachers, because I think it's had probably the biggest impact on their day-to-day work with kind of the state accountability systems that began to appear, oh gosh, now almost two decades ago, 15 years or so ago, followed then in 2001 with the No Child Left Behind Act. I think the important thing to consider about the implementation of those accountability systems is they were in response to a very kind of diverse and fragmented view of what it meant to educate students or for a school to be performing well or for a district to performing well. You know, in the business world, you have some pretty well accepted measures that prove whether or not a business is performing well without some way to assess whether or not schools were educating students. The conclusion was that some students were actually being educated to a pretty high level, and to the caller's point, not just so that they do well on tests, but so that they were truly educated. And we had a whole set of students in predictable subgroups that actually were not succeeding in kind of some of the life measures that you would expect to see if students had been educated well. And so the testing regime was really in response to huge inequities. I mean, it's the case now that African American and Latino students nationwide on the only national test we have, which is the National Assessment for Educational Progress, the NAEP, which we've given every year since 1970, African American and Hispanic students by age 9 are about 3 grade levels behind their white and Asian counterparts. And so the testing regime was an effort to say, you know, is there a way that on a more consistent basis we can measure whether or not all students, not just some students and not maybe historically which students we've been able to educate well, are all students having equal access to a high-quality education? Are there problems with the testing regimes? Sure. And, you know, there's a lot of progress to be made there. But kind of having no way to measure versus some way to measure, I think, is a step in the right direction.
Alan, you want to talk about...
Yeah, well, I was going to address the issue of discipline, and the caller is quite right. You know, times have changed, and that's exactly, I think, what the response that we're looking at. How do you change districts so that it can accommodate the changes in society? And certainly discipline is a problem, but what's very interesting is when we look across districts and talk to the best teachers and the best principals, we find that you do need on some level some punitive, some consequence for really aberrant behavior. No one's against that. But on average, that isn't what works. What really works with students is high expectations and motivating them to learn. And when you take schools that have been consistently underperforming with huge discipline problems, there was a wonderful principal in New York named Lorraine Monroe who about 20 years ago took over a school that was the lowest performing school in Harlem. And what she did was create a set of expectations, develop her teachers so that there was no excuse. It wasn't a question that I taught them and they didn't learn. It was a question that we've got to work together to understand what we're doing that perhaps, as your caller said, isn't really in line with today's youth. And that school became one of the highest performing schools in Manhattan. Now, we see that time and again. So, yes, there are students who shouldn't be in class, and they have to be dealt with. But the majority of the students are looking for an opportunity, and that has to be created by us, by the adults. These students are here. They're part of our population, and we've got to create high expectations and then deliver on those expectations with excellent teaching.
And David, just a short follow to that. I think, you know, to kind of sum up the observation Alan's making, the focus has to be on what are schools bringing to students versus what do students bring to schools. If we continue to focus on what students bring into the schools, we'll get what we've always had, which is some kids who come with a different kind of social capital, if you will others, will do well, and others will not. If we focus instead on what is it that schools add to students and schools bring to students, then we have to think very differently about what it means, as the caller says, to really educate students versus just leaving it up to them to get it or not get it.
We're headed into our last 15 minutes, and I have now several other callers, and I want to thank the last one and see if we can get everybody in the time that remains. And I should also, for a benefit of anyone who has just tuned in, introduce again our guests. Stacy Childress is a lecturer in the Entrepreneurial Management Unit at Harvard Business School. She's also co-founder and senior researcher of the Public Education Leadership Project at Harvard, where they now, over a number of years, have been looking at, studying, working with some very large urban school districts to try to see if it's possible to learn some things about what they do well and where their problems are as a way of improving public education, and specifically about the education that's delivered in these very big city districts. Also joining us is Alan Grossman. He is professor of management practice at the Harvard Business School and is involved as well with the Public Education Leadership Project. Questions welcome. We have several. We'll try to get everybody in the time that remains. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have a caller here, been very patient with us, in line number one in Champaign. We will go right there. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I would submit that every time the government tries to fix something, the exact opposite thing happens and it ends up more broke than it was. Kind of piggybacking on the previous caller, I think this effort is going to eventually lead to the destruction of the public school system. And the reason I say that is everybody is now teaching to the test. They're focusing on the very statistics that your guests seem so focused on. And what this eventually means is a given school will focus on a very specific set of students, usually this is a very small number of students, who have the ability by improved testing skills to make the school look like it's doing better. And what this does is it leaves the average kid behind. So I really think we're going the wrong direction here.
Well, either
I'll take that on. Yeah, I think that's a legitimate concern for all of us. And that's why we see evolution in how we're thinking about testing. So, for example, if you look out at Long Beach or even what's happening now in Chicago, it isn't all students have to reach a minimum level of reading anymore. It's all schools, regardless of where they are, have to improve and have to continuously improve. So in Long Beach, where there's a high school where 80 or 85% of the students, way above average, are actually either proficient or at a high level in reading and math, the district is not saying to them, well, you're fine, we don't have to pay attention to you. What they're actually saying is, you set your targets and you have to improve. And so that's very different from saying we have to get everyone to a minimal level. We may have to do that, but the caller is right. That runs the risk of only addressing the lower performing students rather than all students. The other thing is there is a danger here. The way the federal law is written, the No Child Left Behind, states can develop their own tests. And some state tests are, frankly, just minimal tests. They're basic skills. There are other states, and we live in Massachusetts, which has a critical thinking test. It's a rather, by all measures, a rather good test. Now, rather than just the lower performing students improving, what it's actually done is caused most students in the state to actually improve. So we can't dismiss testing. I don't know of a single area of business or nonprofits or government that doesn't measure itself in order to improve. The measurement at this point may not be ideal, but the answer is not let's not measure ourselves. The answer is let's get better measurement in place so that it does reflect the learning of students.
But simply measuring something is not really telling the whole story here. First of all, here in Illinois, I believe they use the ACT test to test high school juniors. Well, what if you don't care about the ACT test? There's an assumption that the kid cares about the test. I think that assumption is flawed. I think the notion that somehow everybody's going to all perform to the same baseline flies in the face of what every businessman knows, that they're not at the same baseline, and they never will be.
No, you're quite right, and that's exactly why we have to look at relative gains from wherever they are. In terms of whether a student is interested in a test or not, I frankly don't think that that's the real issue. We have a responsibility to try and help all students leave high school college ready so that they can enter the workforce. You know the data as well as I do about how much less young people earn when they don't get a college degree. Now, at least we're not saying every student should have that college degree by mandate. What we're saying is that every student should have the opportunity to go to college if she or he wants to. Now, that, whether we like it or not, is based on a certain rigorous set of academic skills. We're trying to identify them and make sure that they are way above the minimal level of thinking to a critical level of thinking, and that all students continuously advance in public schools, not just focus on the bottom percentage of performers.
David, I'll defer the next caller.
All right, keep going. Thanks for the call. Let's go then to Champaign County. This is line number two. Hello.
Hi, yeah.
Yes.
I understand that the Children's Defense Fund actually offered a program, and that the No Child Left Behind disaster is actually sort of a kind of a distortion of that, including, you know, the idea that you fail the school fails and you defund them or let everybody leave the school as a solution is analogous to, if the student fails, kicking them out. And that's not the way it's supposed to be in the school, and it shouldn't be at the higher level. I think it's this market model business. But I had another question, and I'm sorry to pile them all up as usual, but I agree with the previous caller that the distortions of this bill are from people who want, you know, to see public schools fail, in my opinion. But there's another thing, and that's the idea of, I think it's called the Hawthorne effect. Is if you just change something, they did this in a factory floor, they just changed things, and just people responded to the change, not necessarily the substance of just change, but just the idea that, well, people are paying attention. And I think there's an analogy here, as well as the idea that if students are expected to be able to go forward, then you know, that may be a change, because a lot of students are expected to fail. And I don't want to chime in with Bush's what is his line about
The soft bigotry of low expectations.
That's it, right. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, well, Stacey, if you want to go on with that, I would be interested in anything that you would have to say about No Child Left Behind.
Right. Well, you know, again, our work is obviously relevant and has to take the No Child Left Behind parameters into account. I will say we haven't spent significant time kind of pulling apart the law and trying to understand its strengths and weaknesses. Our work intersects with it as it does with practitioners who are really trying to run schools and these large districts on the ground and deal with the requirements of No Child Left Behind. That said, I think that this notion that the caller mentioned in his last comment about the effect that a change in just the mere expectation of why we're all here at school and the effect that can have on students. And we see it, you know, in one of the common characteristics of these individual schools that we see, whether they are public, you know, traditional public schools in big districts or charter schools or other kinds of schools, when schools begin to make progress with a set of kids who traditionally have not done well before in schools, one of the common characteristics is a change in the set of expectations that the adults in the school have for the students and for each other. And so a culture of high expectations that it's just assumed that you're going to do well, that we're going to give you the support you need to be able to meet those high expectations, begins to change the way people interact with each other, both the adults and the students. So this notion that by changing the mindset that adults in the school and around the school have for whether or not it's okay for students to do well or not to do well can have an enormous effect on how the students themselves begin to approach the work. Now, that's hard work. It's not a one-shot deal. It's something that has to be lived day in and day out in the schools, and we have some examples of that, again, both inside and outside the system. You may be familiar with KIPP Academies. They're one of the charter school operators that has a number of schools, over 50 now around the country, and you know they've really taken that idea of raising the expectations that all children will do well and putting that kind of at the very front of their approach with both families and students and teachers and really trying to operationalize that day-to-day so it shows up in every aspect of the way they design and run their schools. And we're seeing that in schools in Chicago, in San Diego, San Francisco, New York. There's a study out of Arizona called Beating the Odds, where schools that have been successful with Latino students, this is one of the common characteristics that your caller mentions. Just the idea that you change the expectation and you keep that very consistent over some period of time, and students will respond to that, as will adults.
Just to add to that, you know, we've had a focus on public education. We know that it's been underperforming for the last 35 or 40 years. In reality, we keep asking superintendents and leadership teams, so what changed in the last 10 years? And almost without exception, they do say that it is the imposition of tests, of standards, of that has changed dramatically how they perceive, one, their job, the role of the public school system, and the set of expectations that they bring into the classroom. I'm not in favor, as your last caller said, of government controlling things, but there is a role for government, and they seem to have fulfilled the role, at least at the first stage, of setting a set of standards that we simply didn't have before, and it does seem to be the impetus to get people to rethink their role as educators.
All right, we'll try and see if we can get at least one more caller here. We'll go next in line to somebody in Champaign. This would be line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Jonathan Kozel recently has published his findings about the effects of resegregated schools throughout the country, particularly in large urban school districts. And he argues that there's something hypocritical about cultural elites imposing high expectations and business principles on low-funded and underfunded schools when they send their own children to high-funded schools. So I'm wondering if your guest could address the question, which is, the last time I looked, the disparity in funding in public schools in Illinois is somewhere around $10,000. How are business principles going to work with underfunded, resegregated schools of poverty? Thank you, and I'll hang up.
Excellent question.
It is a good question, and it's a terrible challenge. This is not business principles or good management or good leadership replaces other essentials. This is a much more a question of, given a certain amount of resources, how do we do best with them? Now, in reality, if you look at the fact that a high schooler in Illinois receives $6,500 per pupil, they're vastly underfunded. Would you then calculate the number of the 13% who are special education, who require sometimes $30,000 or more to be educated? I agree with the caller. It doesn't replace them. And so we have to move along. This is not a silver bullet. What we're not saying here is that we have the answer. What we are saying is that we have part of an answer that hopefully, once people feel that there is not just hope, but that the money is being spent very well, that would be a better platform to go to state legislators and say, look, we're doing as well as we can with this money, but frankly, it's not nearly enough. And there are urban districts, New York City, there was just a ruling yesterday in terms of how much the state has to pony up. It's $1.8 billion a year that they have been underfunded. So your caller's quite right. But the answer is still, let's do as well as we can with the resources we have.
We're almost out of time. Is there some last thing that you'd like to mention, Stacey?
Well, I think your caller raises a very important problem, and it's similar to a number of others. You know, one is certainly this underfunding of many urban, although not all urban districts, many urban districts, and I know that's a particular problem in Illinois as it is in California and some other states. There are a variety of environmental factors around big urban districts that make it very difficult for leadership teams, both at the district level and at the school level, to focus on improving performance, whether that's politics, funding, kind of lack of agreement about what success looks like. And, you know, as a kind of a final word, our plea to business leaders, politicians, local and state and federal policymakers is to really put performance at the center of debates about how to improve and support the improvement of schools versus politics or ideology or power. Because as long as the conversations around schools, again, at the local, state, federal level, are about control and about power and about whose ideology is right, what gets lost in the din of that debate is the fact that there are hundreds of thousands of students in urban school districts who don't have access to the kind of education that students in other parts of our country have, as your last caller pointed out, and that if we can, again, focus on making the systems as they are better and reframe the stakeholder conversations that go around schools to be more about performance and not about whose idea is right and which adult is correct, then I think we are at least working on parallel tracks to fixing the problems at the macro level, the systemic level nationally, as well as district to district to district in states.
All right. There we must leave it because we're here at the end of the time. With our thanks to Stacey Childress. She's a lecturer in the Entrepreneurial Management Unit at Harvard Business School. Stacey, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And Alan Grossman. He is professor of management practice also at Harvard Business School. Alan, thank you.
Thank you, David.